Hello and welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast on the 29th of August 2025. Joined today by Kane and Katerina, and we had a good session on the Online Safety Act. How did you think it went, guys?
I thought it was great. It was one of those really good sessions where time just kind of flies. You know, we had a few sessions like that, but before you know it, it's half one. But I thought, yeah, a really interesting topic. It's something that is very, very hot in the news at the moment. There's lots of stuff coming out about it, a lot of different opinions. I think personally, when we was talking about sort of like, so almost like the broader sort of societal implications, was probably the most interesting point for me, as much as it does relate to data protection. The topics were, I suppose, more largely about the act as a whole, and our sort of view and opinions of it. And for me, when we were talking about sort of the youth and children in the whole and how they'll sort of perceive the act and how maybe there could be workarounds behind the act and maybe a lack of sort of diligence on the care of website runners at the moment. Those are probably some of my favourite things to talk about today in the session. I don't know about you, Kate. I don't know what you enjoyed for today.
Yeah. I think it was actually very interesting to explore, like, what these actually criticisms mean for the Online Safety Act. And when we talked about age assurance, robust age checks, what does that mean? We talked and touched a little bit about the guidance from Ofcom and facial age estimation. And we explored a little bit about what is that supposed to mean. But I feel I feel that is a very good point on the Online Safety Act, and it is a good first step to understand the risks that this online world and the social media and so user providers have. But I do think in the end of the day, everything should be aligned with education and resilience and literacy from not educational sector and the parents' side. But yeah, what about you, Phil? What did you like the most on this session?
I think I liked most. We didn't really discuss it explicitly very much, but it's definitely there underlying everything, which is the interplay between the GDPR, the Online Safety Act, the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, the Data Protection Act. So, you know, we talked about age verification. We talked about, you know, do you need to retain that data? If you do, then obviously regulated by the GDPR. Yeah, and the risks of that information getting compromised. We talked, and that to me was the big takeaway for me, was like, this needs a bit more thinking through about the interplay between all the different elements of legislation and code of practice to make achieve the objective of online safety, but also achieve, you know, the objective of freedom of expression and also achieve the objective of privacy. And there's more, I think, to think about and talk about that interplay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who knows about it too?
Yeah, it's very layered, I think. I mean, there's a lot of broader things to think about, but we won't give too much away. We'll let you dive straight into the session, and we hope you enjoy.
Week.
It's been a 4-day week. It felt like it'd been like a 10-day week.
If you've seen the way that Kate's been sort of running back and forth through the offices, jumping from sort of pillar to post, then it's, I think Kate's had like the longest week maybe in the history of DPP.
In history, I think so.
Well, I can never pin Kate down, so I don't doubt that at all.
Yeah. No, but you know, to be honest, it's been a very good week. Unfortunately, as you know, one of our members is leaving, Susan.
Yeah.
So it's kind of to making sure that all around here is planned and everyone has work to do.
Right.
And planified everything alongside with, I'm listening to myself. With audits, I've been to London last week with Kathy to visit a client, which was very nice.
Yeah, very good, very good.
That was me. What about yourself?
I've had a funny week. Office on Tuesday, looking with you guys at sort of strategy and product development and packaging and things like that, which is really interesting. I've done some quite technical stuff with Kenne on SOC 2. That's an American security standard. We've got some work going on there. So I accompanied her just to observe, really, at a meeting in Leeds this week. I've been on some calls about facial recognition technologies, which have been quite interesting, and some biometric fingerprinting stuff. With a customer, that's been interesting, and I had a meeting with the same customer about their consent management platform. Again, that was quite interesting to get into the detail of that. So I've had a really interesting week, actually. I did some work with Benga. He's been doing a piece, again, on the company that is trying to leverage their databases, and they've got like 4.7 million records, and they're trying to kind of move to a position where they're doing outbound, unsolicited direct marketing, which will take some time and some structure to move to that position. So he's done some brilliant work on that, and I was just kind of QAing it for him before it got released to the client. So I had a great week, actually, and this, of course,
is very good.
being the highlight of the week.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's been again a bit of a similar one to you, Phil. I've been working through a lot of sort of like operational bits. Was working through the stuff with you all obviously on Tuesday about some products and stuff, which was exciting. Been looking at a lot of product lists for support, which may be less exciting. But going through sort of those sort of bits, jumping around, working on some transitional bits for some of the members of support as well, which have been nice. It's been a busy week. I'm sure Kate can definitely attest to that. And sounds like you as well, Phil.
And only 4 days. I mean, you know, cram a lot of stuff into it.
I don't know. Yeah. I completely forgot that was on Tuesday. I thought it was just
I was away all last week. I was off all last week. It feels like an age away.
And that's very true. How was your holiday? Was everything all right? Yeah.
It was great. Thank you. Yeah, I went sailing in the Solent, which was good. My wife and my oldest daughter did a course. I was there just kind of to clock up some training miles, really, because I did the course in 2018. I did do a course, actually, and an exam on the operation of VHF radios in marine environment. So anyway, it was great. We had fantastic weather. We had great winds. It was really good fun.
That's very good. I told Phil that Kane that we should do a team building in sailing.
Sailing.
I think that would be very interesting.
Yeah. I think it would be good fun.
Maybe a bit dangerous, but we'll
dangerous.
Nah. Why?
Anyway, so what's been in the news? I tell you what, we had some breach calls yesterday from some of our customers about this, and it's in the news now about the DBS contractor that has had a data breach. It's one of their suppliers, actually. So it's kind of process of breach.
Is this the Intradev one, Phil?
Access Personal Checking Services Limited, APCS Limited. Interestingly, the complaints about the breach came from Guernsey through their Office of the Data Protection Authority, and they've notified the UK that they think there's been a potential breach. APCS has been quite stum about it, but it seems to have been caused by a third-party contractor. Well, are you referring to a different breach, Kane?
Yeah, so I had a similar one that was going on a little bit earlier in the week, actually. I think it was a subcontractor called Intradev, and it was basically like a big hefty chunk of our customers who have been affected by a similar breach. So it was I'm trying to think specifically what they did. I think it was in relation to like a database that they manage. Well, that seems to affect a fair few of our customers, so I'm sure there's probably even some people in the chat today that may have dealt with something similar. They sent comms round to all the controllers, notifying of it, basically saying that they're going to go to the ICO and basically have encouraged people to do the same, had stuff like passports involved and stuff along that lines. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that you've seen a similar one as well, Phil. I don't know if that's...
It might be the same one, might be different brand. I don't know. It was on BBC News, so it could well be the same thing. Yeah, just a short story on BBC News.
Yeah. Yeah. The majority of the that was around schools, so
it was
actually very
sector.
Education sector.
But I had a few. So there we go. They hold the single central records for schools, so that may obviously we have a load of customers in the educational sector, so. Makes a lot of sense why we were sort of having our phone line sort of blowing up over the Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday kind of period.
Yeah. Now, this makes a fantastic segue, which I'm not going to jump on at the moment, into the Online Safety Act, because, you know, all this sensitive data held in one place is potentially quite vulnerable. But before we do that, moving on to the main thing, I also read, I don't know if you read it in the news, the parking scam, card readers, so this is credit card readers attached to ticket parking machines in the Bishop Auckland area. So you kind of go up and you pay your thing. You swipe your card, and there's a rogue battery powered reader on there reading your card and then transmitting your information to someone else. So that was really alarming, really. So skimming parking machines. But also I've read about rogue QR codes on parking machines. So you scan the QR code to get the, you know, your location, and it takes you to a different place. So that was, again, quite alarming.
Yeah, that is interesting. Yeah. I mean, I always use the apps for those kind of things anyway, just because it feels a little bit more controlled in terms of that environment. It
feels a little bit more modern.
And it's easier.
It makes it easier.
And if you're parking in stuff like the city centre, then it's easier than the barcode stuff, because they are, I suppose, they're a lot more vulnerable if they're easily changed. Easy enough for someone to just go and...
Well, they're unattended. I mean, she's basically unattended, aren't they? Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we used to have a contract to go around Europe testing petrol forecourt stations, you know, in most, it's only recently introduced here, but in mainland Europe, you could go and rock up to a petrol station, fill up and pay by credit card, couldn't you? You used to be able to do that. They've been doing it for donkey's years. But it's a relatively recent introduction in the UK. But anyway, we used to go around Poland and Spain and France testing that. I didn't do it, sadly.
Oh, like the pay at the pump sort of stuff.
Yeah. I get all the dull bits of work, but he used to get all the good bits. and I also saw the ICO have reprimanded South Yorkshire Police for deleting 96,000 pieces of body-worn video evidence. I don't know if you saw that in the press. Mm. Again, a contractor. Now, the ICO has been really critical of South Yorkshire Police, basically saying that whilst they might have a data processor agreement in place, it didn't specify in sufficient detail the work that they were going to do. It seemed that there was no insufficient controls over the work they were doing. So this contractor accidentally deleted all this video evidence, which was relating to the live cases. Mm. And the ICO only come out with a reprimand, but... Okay. Again, it's quite interesting, isn't it? You know,
where's the weak link for the nature of this week as well, with a couple of other things that we've mentioned. There's clearly a little bit of a running theme with your supply chain, and obviously the risks that come with not just personal data breaches that may be caused by you internally as an organisation, but also that branch out externally with your whole supply chain, not always just direct processors, but obviously their subcontractors, your sub-processors, and sort of the... I think it's a little bit easy to let that stuff sort of fall to the wayside and not give it as much attention as it needs. But obviously, as you can see in what's happened this week, these things are really important in making sure that we're very happy with processes and sub-processes compliance.
Yeah, I mean, we know that the Data Protection Act, which obviously applies to South Yorkshire Police, isn't specific, nor is the GDPR in what you should put in there. But the ICO said it didn't provide any granular detail to specify how this process, either deletion, and in fact, it wasn't a deletion. They were moving data from one platform to another. There was a problem with their third-party platform. So they decided to store data locally. And then when they got the third-party platform sorted out, then a contractor was employed to move the data from the local platform back up to the main platform. But, you know, they're saying you didn't give them specific instructions. I mean, the question is how specific do you need to be? But you definitely need to understand the process, don't you? Also, they said they had no backup policy, you know, or insufficient backup policy, and they couldn't demonstrate it had complied with its data protection obligation. So quite damning, actually, in their reprimand.
Yeah, no, I would say so. That's definitely very interesting and feels... Yeah. On topic to the nature of this week as well.
Yeah. We saw as well that the ICO finally provides some guidance about the complaints procedure.
Yes, indeed.
That was very exciting, I must say, finally. So I think if I'm correct, the consultation process goes into the end of October this year. And then all the organizations must have a formal procedure by June next year. So everything must be prepared. We're already making sure that our clients are advised in terms of any information or any advising must be taken in terms of strategy, planification. But I think finally it's good to have some guidance and instructions on how this process will look like.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
good stuff.
Yeah, very good stuff.
Anything else you saw in the news?
Not for me, no. No. Okay. Can if there's like some technical issues.
Right. Okay.
Not for me, no.
Right. So Online Safety Act.
Oh, let's do it. Where is this Online Safety Act?
Well, exactly. We put this down as, you know, we're going to have a look at this. And my initial reaction was, right, okay, let's have a quick look at it.
Yeah.
I said to Kane yesterday, you know, oh, I hope it's quite quick to read. I was optimistic.
Not. It was very optimistic who thought about that, because it's absolutely huge.
303 pages, long. But actually, I found the Ofcom guidance the most useful. I spent a lot of time looking at the Ofcom guidance, and it's actually pretty good, to be fair.
Yeah. I thought, to be honest, doing the podcast prep, I did some reading as well for the agreement that they have with the ICO as well, like in terms of how do they work together, the joint statement between both of them, in terms of like putting the children's protection and how the Online Safety Act alongside with the UK GDPR is quite interesting as well. I may as well to include here the link. But a potential, I would say, like the Online Safety Act, like the main core purpose is kind of create a regime for online services to reduce the risk of illegal content activity and protect the children from harmful content.
Yeah, I mean,
probably this was the main purpose.
The focus is obviously on children. It also it kind of relates to like harmful content as a whole, doesn't it? But I think that sort of the onus is on the specifically like high risk sort of like content that's going out there. So specifically things like porn sites and stuff like that. But it relates largely to like any sort of services in the main that's largely going to be accessed by children. So similar to the sort of stuff that we see in like the children's code and then sort of the idea of appropriate code of conduct and stuff like that, which is interesting, I think, to say the least, that there's that very intent. I don't know if it is intentional, but there is that link between the two.
I
was interested in that link between the two, because I thought, well, why have we got this when we've already got the age-appropriate design code of practice? But the age-appropriate design code of practice isn't actually the law, is it?
That's just not
a statutory code of practice. So it can be taken in consideration by the courts, but it's not actually, you know, legislation. Obviously arose out of legislation, but it itself is just a statutory code of practice. And it only relates to design as well, doesn't it? So it's much more about designing from a privacy perspective, which is why I guess the ICO regulates it. It's much more about the design and anti-nudge techniques and misuse of data and transparency. It's not really about content. And the Online Safety Act is really about content, isn't it? So I think the two things are different. Interesting that this is regulated by Ofcom. Age-appropriate design code of practice is regulated by ICO. Again, it'd be interesting to see how they, you know, work together as these things push forward. But there's actually already been one case, hasn't there? So Wikipedia have challenged some decisions, which we'll probably come on to a little bit later on about that.
There's loads of news about the act in general, which seemingly be sort of a lot of like public sort of distaste about it. Like, I think the majority of the general public aren't very happy with the act in its sort of current position. I think what are they not happy with? I believe a lot of them feel like it's negating sort of like freedom of speech and being able to talk about I think that's the main thing, isn't it? I know
freedom of expression.
Donald Trump
says it is impeachment
on the First Amendment right, which is in relation to freedom of speech. I think that's in relation to a company called 4chan. I don't know. I think it's like a forum of such. Maybe it's something like Reddit, I think. And they are currently trying to sue and pursue legal action, I think, with the UK in relation to its First Amendment rights for the freedom of speech.
I think it's the main content, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of provisions. I looked at that specifically. There's lots of provisions, again, not very clear, provisions for what he calls freedom of expression. It lumps in with privacy, freedom of expression and privacy. There's lots of provisions about when Ofcom is issuing, you know, notices or taking action, it ought to consider freedom of expression and privacy in the context of what it's doing. So, you know, and it refers to the freedom of expression within the law. So, you know, I don't know, you know, is that sufficient protection, or is it really going to stop freedom of expression? I mean, we'll get into it, I think, in a minute in the discussion. So I think the obligations that I kind of clocked on, I mean, firstly, who does it apply to? Yeah, so, you know, who is caught by the requirement to comply with the Online Safety Act? That's probably the first thing to talk about, isn't it? I think we've talked about broadly what it's trying to achieve. Mm. So what did you make of that? In the way, there's three categories of, I don't know why they got a category one, category two A, and category two B, as opposed to category one, two, and three. But anyway, there's three categories, and category one, you know, to be a category one regulated service provider, then you've got to have more than 34 million UK users on mm-hmm. your system, which represents about 50% of the UK population, and it has to be, you know, allowing the forwarding or resharing of user generated content for about 7 million people, about 10% of the UK population. So category one is quite big, isn't it? You've got to be quite big to be falling into category one. And with if you're in category one, then there's a ton of additional obligations you've got to comply with. Is that how you read it?
I think so. Yeah, I don't think I actually even caught the bit that breaks it down into sort of like the percentages. I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's not in the Act. It's in the Ofcom guide. In fact, it's in an Ofcom recommendation to the Secretary of State. So again, I'm not entirely sure. I guess that's probably how it's going to be. The category two is if you're a search service. We'll come on to these services in a minute, because it applies to user services and to search services, doesn't it? And they have to be regulated, what they're called regulated. Mm. So category 2A is a search service, but not what they call a vertical search service, which looks like it's within a particular sector or within a particular subject area. So a general search service. You've got more than 7 million UK users, represent about 10% of the UK population. So if you're in that category, you're a category 2A provider. And category 2B is a platform that allows you to send direct messages and has more than 3 million users on the user-to-user part of the service. Again, they're quite large numbers, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Really big. I mean, to be honest, I would say that potentially this will be applicable to everything that's, I don't know, user-to-user services, search services, anything potentially online, I would include within the Online Safety Act. But it's interesting to see that different categories, just because of numbers and percentages, will have different obligations.
Why is that the case? Because surely harmful content could still be provided to like a very small population of people. I suppose it does change the risk if it's going to like the masses, because it's a more controlled group. But
well, I think again, if you think of the obligations, sorry to you carry on, sorry Kane, I cut right across.
No,
rude of me.
No, go ahead.
Never do a thing like that.
No, I'm happy for you to go ahead.
So I was going to say, you think about what your obligations are on mm-hmm. the providers, you know, protecting users from illegal content, protecting users from fraudulent advertising, and I think they're the two key things, aren't they? Mm-hmm. And the illegal content is then broken down into 17 primary things and then some secondary things as well. So again, we're taking a risk-based approach. So a category one provider has got a ton of obligations to comply with. And, you know, if it's 50% of the UK population, then fine. You know, if you're a relatively small provider, 3 million is still a lot, isn't it? 5% of the UK population. Then you don't have to do half as much in terms of regulation. Mm. You know, so it's just taking, I think it's just, again, taking what they would think would be a proportionate, sensible, risk-based approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, to be honest, probably it's like thinking about potentially scope and burdens for smaller community sites, potentially, because in principle all these requirements can be on one side quite heavy for example non-profits, community sites that are more like smaller.
I
think about Meta and I think about, I don't know, WhatsApp, and I think about these massive things, but we cannot forget that obviously the online world include these big companies, but also a smaller community. So, and we are trying to achieve with the Act, like requirements are applicable to all of them. So potentially could go that way.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, I think I've seen that like some of the requirements of the Act are actually forcing some like services to close just because of like basically a pure inability to comply effectively. Mm-hmm. So even things that are run by like very minute number of people, a very, very small number of people that might be caught by the scope of it but seemingly are just like shutting down in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What's interesting though is Wikipedia you would think would be a big thing, right? A big global phenomena. And they've been challenging through the courts whether they're a Category 1 service provider or not. And the decision, I think, was that they weren't a Category 1 service provider. And what the, again, if you read the judgment, they're saying, yeah, that Wikipedia would have to change lots of things, you know, architecture, technologies, you know, in the background, if they were a Category 1 service provider. So it's not just the small players, I think, that have got some serious reworking to do if they are Category 1. You know, even, you know, big players like Wikipedia, maybe, I mean, they're big names.
Yeah,
organizations or not, who knows, but. So that was interesting that, you know, you got those that particular big name, you know, fighting, pushing back, saying, oh no, we're not Category 1, you know, because if we are, you know, effectively we're out of business with all the changes we've got to put in.
Yeah, I mean, it does seem like it's sort of heading towards that way. It does seem like a lot of, to probably name it Wikipedia, but quite a few of us are unhappy with, I suppose, like the actual cost in trying to implement a lot of these changes, which could lead into sort of the general sort of like public perception of it as well. Because it doesn't seem like public perception of it is currently that high, whether it is for businesses or just members of the public.
Well, you've got an option to not trade in the UK.
Yeah.
You know, that's the option, isn't it?
It's true. Yeah.
Geo-block it. So, the categorization was interesting and the threshold. So that, you know, and the Act applies to user-to-user services, you know, a service that content is generated directly by the user, uploaded or shared to the service by a user, and may be encountered by another user or other users of the service. So kind of user-to-user services are regulated, some are. And then search services, kind of internet service that is or includes a search engine. So it don't have to be just a search engine, it could be something that's got a search engine, you know, built in within it. So they're the kind of the things that are regulated by the Act. Don't know if you had any thoughts on whether that's comprehensive enough. You know, it's a lot of websites and apps and, you know, video sharing platforms. There's loads of stuff, dating services, stuff caught by it.
It feels like basically everything in the mix, even stuff with like direct messages and stuff. You can see it's affecting organizations like Xbox and Microsoft with a piece of news specifically like pertaining to Xbox in terms of like age verification measures. Obviously, as we know, as part of the Act, platforms need to be able to assess the age of users accurately now in a way that's basically proportionate is the key word. Whether it has been proved to be proportionate or not, I think, is a different story. But with Xbox, I think they were cutting down basically access to the whole service. So if they hadn't verified their age, they can't like receive invites to games, they can't talk on like parties or in party chats and stuff like that. I was wondering the actual like implication of whether you age verify and you are under 18, does that mean these things are still like cut off as limits for you? It doesn't seem like I understand that there may be harmful content on things like sort of like online like game chats and stuff like that when you have loads of different people sort of around the world talking, but is the extent to that you just sort of cut it off?
It's not, because I mean, what happens if there's a likelihood, and again, this resonates with the Age Appropriate Cane Design Code of Practice. You know, we provide a website. Let's say we're a football club, right? And we provide a website, and you know, there's a high likelihood that children, people under 18, are going to access that website. Then you're caught by the Age Appropriate Design Code of Conduct. If you're providing forums for people to chat. Let's say you're a big club like Grimsby Town these days, and you've got fan forums and things of that nature. We're prepared to get onslaught by the Man United fans. Not anymore. So yeah, imagine you've got chat forums and things. I mean, you've got to get above this 3 million threshold. But I mean, if you did, because you're a big club, then you'd also get caught by the Online Safety Act as well. So the first thing is, if you have to do a risk assessment, is our content likely to be accessed by children? Yeah, it is, right? Yeah, okay, is it accessed by children? And one of the ways you would do that is by saying, well, what's the age verification process? Does that sufficiently identify over 18s or under 18s?
They try to base it off of risk, don't they, as well, if I'm right, from the Act, and that the more harmful content has to be more specific and granular, which I suppose leads to decisions from organisations, you know, things like football clubs like this, you know, how say if we are Grimsby, how likely is the actual risk of them being on these forums being? So how granular does this age verification need to be? Obviously, the age verification process in general is posing lots of questions in terms of like privacy concerns, which I think they're very right in raising, because there are the I definitely have seen quite a few like raising concerns specifically in the news and from what I've seen through using.
Let me just go. Have you read the Ofcom guidance about facial? How do you prove your age? I don't know if you had a chance to read that.
No.
I saw something about that they allow kind of facial age estimation and ID kind of document checks and even the use of third party age assurance providers.
Yeah, they're called like YOP or something. They keep cropping up a lot.
Yeah,
like
and the YOP one is the one in Xbox One, isn't it?
That's the one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I tried to sign up to do something that this week and age verification. I couldn't get my camera to work on my phone. It wouldn't link to the app, so I didn't manage to do it. But anyway,
but how do you effectively age verify off of a face? Because like for me personally, I had a beard at 15 years old. So so do you?
No, it's actually a very good point, to be honest, because. What is that supposed to mean, facial age estimation? Because there are people that actually look younger and people that look much, much, much older than they actually are.
Yeah, I'm in the former category, of course. So the thing that that Ofcom guidance says, I mean, ultimately, are these more robust than just providing a date, my date of birth? Yes, they are. Facial age estimation, show your face via a photo or video and technology analyse it to estimate your age. So that's AI, isn't it? AI powered. Again, makes you wonder, where's the data going? Is it stored?
I've seen a lot of statements that say that they don't store it, which I don't know how, to what extent. I believe, I don't know like how feasible that is. I don't know if it's the case where they scan my face, they technically like will approve it, and then basically like whatever device that is or whatever login I'm using is approved by that mechanism. And if you use something called, I think Yopper is called, or Yop is, then it will tie it all to obviously one third party. So as long as it goes through that third party, then you'd be approved. But
yeah.
I suppose the risk is in that third party holding the general populace of the UK's
If they are.
I'd like to see how they're able to not retain, like basically like not retain them at all, because they're processing it.
Well, it's like when everywhere you go and you know, you check into a hotel, I need a copy of a driver's license. Why do you need a copy of a driver's license to verify this, that, and the next thing? We don't need a copy of it, you just need to see it. Don't you? But everyone's obsessed with keeping copies of ID verification. You know, SARS. Oh, I've got a SAR in. Oh, I need a copy of your passport. Why do you need a copy of it?
You really don't. Yeah, it's something that we circled back on in the in-person event we did quite a while ago, wasn't it? Where the need to verify ID doesn't have to be as granular and as structured as people are making out. Sometimes it's as easy as marking up a signature that's aligning with a system. You know, you've already got something. What's the need and the proportionality in collecting something new? There isn't one. There isn't one really.
I agree. To be honest, I saw something in LinkedIn earlier. There was some comments about a guy commenting about the Online Safety Act against it, and main problem being these age assurance and robust age checks. What does that mean? And to be honest, what we're saying is these third parties are collecting the data. We are expecting them to provide ID, driving license, this and that, et cetera, to kind of age check. And then they potentially saying that they are not storing it, but they actually there are cases already that they are actually using that data to potentially advertisements and marketing and any other purposes. So, for example, they are promoting services. Imagine that I am under 18. They are using these third-party platforms, are using the data to, I don't know, like emails or whatever, to actually send advertisements and marketing. And it is insane, I think, because they are actually in the transparency requirements of privacy notices, et cetera, that are stating that they are not collecting any data, storing any data, but they are. And they
No, I think it raises a large concern, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I reckon that most services, or many services, will go down this route because it's easy to implement and it's going to be instantaneous. Absolutely. And it's devoid of human interaction, at the other end. The other methods for ID verification that Ofcom suggests are open banking. So contact the bank, they would know your age. Credit card age checks. So you have to be over 18 to have a credit card. So if you've got a credit card, in theory, you should be over 18. I don't know what this means. Email-based age estimation. Provide an email address and technology analyzes other online services where it's been used. I mean, this is scary Big Brother stuff, as banking and utility providers to estimate your age. Digital identity wallets.
Is it is the same thing with, for example, potentially we were talking now about the VPN. So we actually have the requirements. We say, well done. We have the robust age checks. And please don't get me wrong. I completely understand that we need to do age verification 100%. However, the methods that are being used, and I really understand there are potentially no solution. And I think Ofcom actually says that in the guidance, that there are no magic potion, there are no perfect age mechanisms that can be relied on. These are just examples. But I think people just go around like, okay, you give us the bank check. Okay, I will use my mother's then bank card. Or I use, email address or
interestingly,
something.
Interestingly enough, on that point, in the chat, a few people have raised a really good point that apparently a lot of people are using character images in a video game called Death Stranding. So I think Death Stranding is quite like prolific for looking very impressive, and impressive enough that apparently the AI considers this man, Norman Reedus, a person that's verified as a normal person. I just clicked on the link. I mean, the actual look of the character is very impressive. In terms of like animation standards, and that's easy enough to bypass the actual recognition of it. I think a colleague Ross actually mentioned, I can't remember if it was in relation to the age verification or something else, but they were using a picture of Keir Starmer's driving license, was apparently online, that there's somewhere to use, and they've been using that to access all of these and sort of bypass the sort of like facial recognition requirements, which sets a dangerous precedent, because you're just allowing people to find probably worse or potentially dangerous options of getting alternatives through it.
The VPN thing that we made a very good a blog last week or 2 weeks ago about it, is the fact that we are like after, I think it started like in France and Germany. And now, because of these all these age requirements, etc., people are just relying on a push like to VPNs. So now,
they can appear to be coming from a different location. Why?
Yeah. It negates the use of the age verification. So if you require to use the age verification on something and you put a VPN on, obviously, it will take you out. It doesn't necessarily have to put you in a destination country, but it doesn't appear like you're coming from the UK. So you can basically just bypass the need to do it anyway. Obviously, VPN usage is absolutely like surged like massively like since the creation of this act, because there are workarounds, and I think that again sets a precedent of what is the point if there's workarounds. Absolutely. Is there a real point in doing it through this loop if there's not a sufficient and efficient way to do it, instead of just having the grandeur or the image of something that's compliant when there's actually like a lot of back doors? Is there more benefit and weight in terms of something we were talking about literally like before we started, Kit? Is there more benefit and weight in just educating people?
I feel I'm not against the Online Safety Act. I'm not. But to be honest, I have several concerns about it. I think there are too many ifs and too many broad concepts, and it's too broad. I think the fact, for example, I was reading in terms of, for example, the Ofcom's powers. If anything happens, or what can happen if the organizations do not comply, obviously we have the fines, business disruption, information powers and criminal offenses. And then I saw something about the technology and accredited technology notices. So in limited circumstances, Ofcom can require provider to use accredited technology to identify and take down certain illegal content. I think this is so dangerous because I feel that relying on age providers and checked in third party providers and being independent and third parties that are run by profit and money and they still have a business to kind of manage, right? I think can be risky. I see Ofcom as a regulator and not a policy maker. And I feel that they having a power to kind of take down certain illegal content, obviously based on a risk assessment, on obviously based on risks and assessments and or potentially consultation process, etc., can be dangerous because you are relying on a regulator and in a state and in the government to put down content that in their perspective can be considered illegal or not. I'm not saying that it's wrong. I don't see, to be honest, you ask me, okay, what could be the balance or the other solution? I really don't know. But it, I feel this is weird. I feel I don't know how I feel about this. I must admit, I feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in here to unpack. I mean, there's a lot of the Ofcom powers relate to content that is terrorism related or child sexual exploitation and abuse related.
Yeah.
Now I don't. So that when if they issue a notice, they've got they can only issue a notice in respect of those two categories of content, as far as I can see, terrorism and CSEA, and they have to consider freedom of speech as part of that process. I get what you're saying, but I mean, you've got to have it broad, and I like the broadness of it because it gives flexibility. You know, if it's too rigid, there's no way they can get things right. Like the GDPR, it's very broad because you're dealing with a huge array of stuff. So I wonder what people are worried about, why there's a move to VPN. Are they worried about, you know, going through an age verification process and that then being compromised? And, you know, let's say they're signed up to some dating site that shouldn't be, or some pornography site or something.
Well, it's like that
Ashley Madison all over again.
Yes, Ashley Madison. That's exactly what I was thinking of. Obviously, people that are doing stuff like that is obviously, I think there's two camps of people. One, people that are like aware of like the digital footprint and they don't want their data being out there. And then probably two, children who just want to access it anyway. People that are under 18, you know, if you put age verification on things like Pornhub, they'll just download a VPN. Is that negating the risk of harm to a child? No, but what could negate the risk to a child or help that risk to a child is maybe explaining the dangers of this to a child instead of glorifying it maybe or trying to lock it down. Sometimes that just makes children want to, if you shut something down completely, it makes people want to get their hands on it more, I think. So I think it's more of a, to me, I think a moral thing of, instead of trying to shut things down so intensely, is working harder to educate people on the actual risks of things.
Yeah, for building children resilience. In particular.
In terms of the risk to privacy, so how do I, in the Ofcom site, how do I know my information will be kept private? It says, don't worry, the ICO regulates and enforces data protection in the UK. Oh, great. We're all fine then, aren't we?
must be fine.
If the ICO is involved, everyone is fine then.
Yeah. They're really proactive and they really bang down their fist and stamp out bad behaviour. They're absolutely not that, are they? So
not quite. No, not quite.
But I tell you, the fines are high, aren't they? 10% of global...
10% is a lot.
Or 80 million, whichever is higher, isn't it? Yeah,
it's quite high, isn't it? I didn't realise it was a fee regime with this as well, which they haven't actually bottomed yet. You know, so you have to, if you're online certified in the UK, covered by this Act, you're going to have to pay a fee and also register with Ofcom. So the registration process is interesting, where the fees are getting sorted out at the back end of this year. Mm. There's a consultation paper about it, sort of explains the justification for the fees, but don't actually set the levels yet.
Yeah, I'd be intrigued to see what the levels are and sort of how heavily Ofcom are actually going to like be enforcing within the role. Actually, we're saying in comparison to the ICO, there's usually not too much to to speak of in that case. But I would be intrigued to see in the future sort of how that develops and Ofcom's actual involvement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, in terms of what people have to do, what you, it's the first rise they've got to do, so transparency reporting. So there's an obligation to report to Ofcom, you know, on certain things. And that's common in all categories, Category 1, 2A and 2B. And so is disclosure of information about the use of the service by a deceased child. That's also common across all categories. But then, you know, providing user identity verification operations is actually only a requirement if you're a Category 1 provider. According to a table I've got from Ofcom. So if you're a Category 2, that's a, you know, like a big service provider, you know, 50% of the UK population, which seems, again, quite odd. I do have thought that might be rolled down into smaller levels, you know, thresholds. And then you've got to do risk assessments, which again is good. I went through some this morning on the Ofcom site. They're quite good, you know, quite helpful. They've got some really quite helpful material out there, Ofcom.
Are they, is it similar to like the risk assessment the ICO has, like for the children's code? Or?
No, because it's not really focused on design.
It's different. It's a different focus point.
Yeah,
okay.
It's more focused on content. And yeah, you know, the thing is that there's quite a good risk assessment table, and it's going through the things that the Act is trying to stop, like self-harm, eating disorders, suicide, bullying, abusive and hateful content, content which depicts or encourages serious violence or injury, content which encourages dangerous stunts and challenges, content which encourages ingestion, inhalation or exposure to harmful substances. And there's a whole list of other stuff like child sexual abuse, controlling or coercive behaviour. I mean, some of this is very subjective, I think.
It's very subjective.
Extreme sexual violence. Extreme pornography, you know, where's the line?
Is there a level, I suppose, in what?
Yeah.
Because extreme is a very specific word, I think. It's not saying like pornographic activity, end of sentence, it's extreme. So what is the extreme? Is there an extreme? Is it all extreme?
Is it an extreme? I think everything should be an extreme, isn't it? Like when it's harmful, obviously. Than in terms of risk posed.
Well, the definition of pornography in the Act is, again, it's quite a low bar. You know, I can't remember what it is, but you know, it's something that's designed to create sexual arousal, I think, is broadly the definition.
Hmm.
So, you know, that could be lots of different things.
That is incredibly broad, to be honest.
Yeah. So what is extreme pornography? You know, in my book, might be common. You know, commonplace stuff for you guys. I don't know. All the way
yeah.
around.
yeah. Yeah. Well, who knows, I suppose.
But, you know, there's all these things, which is quite good the way it sets out. Yeah, I quite like the way it sets out. It's quite interesting to read. You know, but the application of it, again, is going to be interesting to see how it gets applied in practical terms. And as you say, you know, it is broad. It covers a lot of stuff.
Yeah. I think... To be honest, I was discussing with Kane before the podcast, and I think, to be honest, with how I see Online Safety Act is kind of being caused by the symptoms and not the cause actually of it. I think is focusing a lot, because obviously the problems exist already, so I understand all this pornography is the way the things are, online world is dynamic as
but
it
it's
is.
Not, okay, it's not. This isn't new. When I was at school, into an all boys school. When I was at school, you know, it was not online.
Absolutely, yeah. But what I'm feeling, and to be honest, I all interesting enough. Every single comment that I saw, LinkedIn and news, etc., were very parent wise, and they are making a point that, to be honest, I tend to agree that is rather than removing, for example, content or age. Gating harmful content, which I appreciate and should be done as well, but the requirement should be as well to create and building resilience, education, literacy, giving like parents kind of empowerment in a sense to actually do things, because I understand the age verification things are important, and to be honest, just asking which year have you born and let me know your date of birth, etc. Is self-declaration methods are not sufficient, are not robust. I understand that. But are we not forgetting as well the other side of it? Because I feel that things are happening and things are getting removed, and everything is being published, everyone has an opinion about it, but actually the people that are involved within the act, children, I'm not understanding potentially why this is happening, why these things are being discussed, why are the content being removed, why...
Which means they're just going to find the bad dolls. And that's what I think it leads to, is that if we're going to do this, I think the only way to do it right is to heavily educate the people on why we're restricting this content. It's not because, you know, we want to rain on your parade. It's mm-hmm. because these are harmful and you don't realise the actual implication and harm mm-hmm. of it. And mm-hmm. whilst that's something that I feel like should be done anyway, and it's not necessarily something you can put in a piece of legislation.
No, absolutely not. But it should be like, I saw the news at 13 years old, 12 years old, pornography, and even not going that far, in YouTube there was this massive news of people dying for food disorders because of the advertisements that YouTube was the scandal with YouTube and advertisements, whatever. Yeah. And the ChatGPT as well, all involved. And
it's like these AI girlfriends. Have you seen the stuff with like the AI girlfriends and stuff like that?
I saw. And there is about this new kind of is related to X. Grog. I don't know. There is actually, you can say what will be your girlfriend or boyfriend, and you have.
Yeah, they make you like a dream sort of like partner kind of thing. And I think the AI book is like really like very malicious, or has had things of being malicious. I think a young boy, I think he's like maybe 13 or 14, actually committed suicide for it. There was like encouraging his like, I think, suicidal tendencies, I believe. And of course, these are things that have to measures in place. I completely agree. And if we need to edge verify stuff like that, fine.
Absolutely.
But we also, as I said, there's glaring back doors at the moment. And I think that's because, one, I think people are a bit rushed in, like throwing everything like, oh, we've got to get it in place quickly so they can keep stuff running, of course. Mm. And I think that is the main concern to me, is that people haven't thought about the suppliers they're using, the measures they're using, the compliance measures behind it, retention, purpose limitation, data minimization. Mm. I don't think they've thought about it quickly enough, because it's just like, we got to get this out now because this is important.
So meshing together data protection act stuff with this, yeah.
I think so.
I mean, the record keeping bit is quite interesting, because you've got to keep your risk assessments, you've got to keep your risk assessments up to date, you've got to periodically review them. So again, there's some quite nice bits of regime in here that I think I read some of it, I thought, God, we should have this in the GDPR. We should have some of this stuff in the GDPR, you know, but I mean, it's been in for a very short period of time in effect, hasn't it? It came into effect just over a month ago, 27th of July, wasn't it?
Mm.
But there's been quite a lot of, I think, conflicting news stories as to whether it's actually effective. I don't know if you saw any of those news stories.
I have, yeah. I think the one I seen was from Sky, which was pushing in a, I think it was a youth group in Warrington, that was saying it's actually been really positive. They've had quite a positive experience so far. So they've noticed, algorithmically speaking, that was a bit of a tongue twister, that they're seeing less sort of like harmful content. And they said, like, if they're using things like social media platforms, that they're seeing like, or they were seeing the increasing amount of like very harmful content, whether that's like borderline softcore, soft pornography, things in relation to like self-harm, eating disorders. And they're saying that they've seen a lot less of it. They're saying that social media is still quite a harmful place, but they think that it's going along the right line. So maybe it's not our place to say what works or what doesn't. If we think it's working for the target audience, being the children, then that is the core of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, there's also like Yahoo News and The Guardian were saying it hasn't worked, that it hasn't stopped this. But I was interested to see that Sky one. Funnily enough, I started using Instagram about a week and a half ago. I still haven't figured out what it's about and how to use it. So apologies if I've made any stupid posts or reels or whatever. But I want to try and start using it. I don't remember being asked to do an age verification when I created my account literally about 2 weeks ago, just before I went on holiday, I created it.
Maybe that's an interesting little thing to do, to maybe see if we can. Because social media is cut off by age anyway, isn't it? But it's like 13, which is, in my opinion, I think quite low already. I think 13 is quite a young threshold, I think, potentially. I think he's still quite influential.
I understand that with the age, I'd really, really understand that, because we have Australia 16 now, Portugal, for example, 14, France 15, etc. But I tend to not, I understand that children, considering all the education, and they are influenced because obviously they are growing up, etc., etc. And there are studies about it and corroborating that this age, obviously they are being influenced by the environment they are on. And they have no capacity to probably understand the risks, and I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they are not stupid. You know what I mean? They live in this world since then.
No, we are the ones growing
up with it and getting used to it. They already kind of were literally born and raised within it, and they are already, I don't know, I think.
Well, social media is the go-to for life now, you know, anybody that is around that age, 13, 14, 15.
I think they're a lot more educated.
I think, on the risks of those. But I think on the flip side, there's also the opposite. I think there's a lot of people who, I think there's two camps. There's a lot of people that aren't very well educated and see a lot of things on social media that they take as like gospel, you know, people like Andrew Tate, if people are aware of who he is. Obviously he's a bit of a melon, for lack of better words. But there's a sort of quite a large pocket of like young male people who will listen to his word, like, as I say, like his gospel. And I think as much as we do need to treat children seriously, we also need to make sure that we've got enough in place to prevent that as much. So it's like risk mitigation, isn't it? You can't rule it out, but you've got to do as much as you can to prevent it.
I mean, but that's a problem with the social media, because everything around it is based on your research and then algorithms, and then the cookies based on your phone and everything all connected. And at the end of the day, would you not consider that harmful content? What he promotes, his videos. Because for me, now the question that Phil made in the beginning is, what is actually this? Like, what is like, and to be honest, I would say I would be considering that what, for example, Andrew Tate says and states in his videos and harmful content. For me, it is. But there are a lot of people that go through it and defend that it's freedom of expression and freedom of speech. But, yeah.
No, like, and obviously that's going to be one of the big pushbacks is like freedom of speech. I know Nigel Farage is someone who's quite kind of big on like pushing the scrapping of the act. But as Charlotte mentioned, when she was a teaching assistant, the effect that Andrew Tate and people like him, influencers like that who share negative outlook, should that also be regulated?
We've got a huge societal problem, isn't it? You know, have we got sufficient male role models these days? You know, are the male role models, you know, repressed and suppressed by society, you know, by the new rule book? And we're building these new rules and these new rule books, you know, without really knowing where we're heading. And, so young males looking to Andrew Tate as a role model is dangerous and bad, but why are they looking to him as a role model?
Exactly the point. I saw this very interesting article about the parent that was saying, and she mentioned online role like Andrew Tate or Bonnie Blue for like online only fans kind of social media as well, because we are creating a society that actually based in mental health questions and exposure to extreme and sexualized online like personas that show themselves like self images and are promoting the easy money to get and like financial stuff.
Well, that's right. I think the problem is always, and goes back to
education. I really, really think that education is the main thing here.
But education where, Kate? I mean, we're running out of time, but education where, you know, we can't be surely looking for the schools, right? It's got to come from families. It's got to come from
communities.
Schools and family. I think, to be honest, Phil, I think even parents, they are not aware of actually what is happening. If I go to my parents, they are almost both of them, almost bless them, 70. But they have no idea what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the online world and all these social media, Instagrams. I think it should be
the educational sector, to be honest with you. Parents always put the focal point. Your parents are there to obviously to look after you, and so are educators in that same vein, but
yeah.
I think educators spot it maybe easier than parents can, because I mean, they see it from a broader perspective sometimes.
Potentially, but I mean, I think we cannot say, we cannot take the parents out of the scope. We can't, because obviously you are growing up within a family, well, talking about parents within the family, within the environment, and we need to promote that. We need to promote awareness. We need to promote literacy. We need to promote education and resilience on that self. And we cannot just publishing and online safety acts of, I don't know, and just like raising and deleting and without explaining and making sure that people understand. It's the same with policies and procedures. If people do not understand, why are, you know, are they effective?
Yeah, well,
I agree with Charlotte. A lot of people don't have great situations. But also, you know, parents, I've found some parents are too busy for their kids. You know, they're just busy sometimes on their own lives and they're focused on their own careers. It's a big problem in society.
But I think, you know, I think it's a good sort of round-off point.
Because we're now at 12:31 and everyone will have to go and crack them with the day. But it's been an interesting session. We always kind of, you know, we didn't talk much about data protection stuff, but we did talk a little bit about the Online Safety Act. So anything further thoughts before we wrap it up?
I think the main thing, I suppose, for a lot of people and a lot of things that I want to say is obviously taking risk and this seriously. I mean, as much as it is easy to look at it and maybe not have the sort of brightest sort of connotations of it currently, I do think as long as organizations are taking the right steps and diligence in the kind of suppliers and measures that we're using to verify, then it can be something that works. But I think more diligence has to be taken in order to make this something that can be taken more seriously.
Yeah, I think my latest thought would be that the Online Safety Act kind of will not fix the internet overnight. Would be like is an interesting first step, I would say. Would be amazing if you would do it, but it will not. So I think probably the risks of, like, I don't know, fewer exposures, more risk assessments, more due diligence should be done. But I'm actually very intrigued to see what will come next with this.
Yeah,
well, and on that note, I'd like to say thank you to everyone for joining us. Thank you very much for your contributions in the chat, some interesting stuff, and we sometimes drift off data protection subjects. But thanks for joining us. Have a cracking weekend, and, you know, we'll be in touch with everyone shortly, I hope, about the frequency and the style of our Data Protection Made Easy podcast going forward. So on that note, thank you very much and have a great weekend.
Yeah. Thanks,
thank you. Bye. Bye-bye.